Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective. This is a podcast where I shake every branch of the Coppola family tree to find out, are they the greatest film family of all time? Last week we shook the branch of Armageddon. This week we are looking at the Patricia Arquette starring Flirting with Disaster from 1996. And to join me this week, I have James Hancock from Geeking Out on YouTube and the Wrong Reel podcast. As always, we will get into this film to the nitty gritties. We will talk about every joke that goes throughout this film, every twist and turn that this story may take. So please be aware that there'll be spoilers aplenty. If you haven't seen this film and would like to see it, be sure to check the show notes where there'll be a handy document to show you if and where this film is streaming. If you enjoy my chat with James, be sure to check out the Patreon page where we have an extra little bonus chat all about the man that started this podcast, Nicolas Cage. And you can find that as easily by going over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. So it's time to pack your bags, make a cross-country adventure to find your parents as we make some Coppola connections. In 1996, the Coppola family were very busy. John Swartzman lends Mr. Wrong. His sister Stephanie was an art department coordinator on The Birdcage starring Robin Williams. Francis Ford Coppola also worked with Williams that year in a film about a kid who grows up at an extreme rate. Somewhat a comedy, what some would say. Of course, I'm talking about Jack. And riding high on the highs of his riding high after his best actor win at the Academy Awards for Leaving Las Vegas, Nicolas Cage starred in The Rock. Our focus, however, for this week is a screwball comedy about identity, fidelity and family, with David O. Russell's second directorial effort, Flirting with Disaster. Boasting an all-star cast including Ben Stiller, Lily Tomlin, George Segal, Tia Leone, Mary Tyler Moore, Alan Alda, Richard Jenkins, Josh Brolin and our Coppola connection for today, Patricia Arquette. To help me in the search for Mel Copeland's real parents and look for some Coppola connections along the way is a Wrong Reel podcast host, YouTube presenter, film producer, and self-confessed film geek, James Hancock. How are you, James?
I'm very, very well. Thank you for the invite. I'm thrilled to be discussing the Coppola, I guess, empire at this point, now that it's several generations deep.
The dynasty, yeah. It's that thing when you... when you realize where the kind of spider's web goes. I spoke to some people who go like, you mentioned like the Schwartzman connection. And they're like,
what the fuck? Like, how? Where does that come into it? And I feel like by the end of it, I'm going to have a lot of pins and a lot of string.
Yeah, it's going to get very conspiratorial when it comes to the spider web of connectivity between all the various endeavors.
So first question, is it Coppola or Coppola? How do you pronounce
it? I've always pronounced it Coppola. I would not claim that it's correct. My knowledge of Italian is non-existent. And even if I imagine, because it's mostly an American family at this point, perhaps even they mispronounce it. So I've been saying Coppola for 25 years at this point, but I've heard plenty of people say Coppola as well. And the honest answer is, I don't know what's the right or wrong way.
So when did you first become aware of them as a family? What was your entry point, whether it's a certain
I'd
member?
Seen a lot of their movies going back to my childhood before I even knew who any of them were. I mean, I was born in 76, so on HBO as a kid, I would just stumble into their movies, things like The Outsiders, Peggy Sue Got Married, Tucker, A Man in His Dream. And then I caught Bram Stoker's Dracula in the theater. But then when I got to college, one of my closest friends introduced me to the Godfather films and Apocalypse Now. And my first film class, we watched The Conversation. So it was my first year at the University of Virginia when I was 19, where suddenly I realized, oh, Francis Ford Coppola, not only is he a great filmmaker, but in the 70s, he was kind of the filmmaker. And then from there, obviously, I started learning about his connection to Nicolas Cage and Sofia Coppola and so on and so forth. So yeah, it really was the mid-90s where I became aware of just how vast and just how creative and just how deep the bench of talent is within their family.
Do you have a particular fate? Well, we'll get to that a bit later, actually. I'm not gonna blow my load early by asking who is your favorite member of the Coppola
family. Speaking of blowing loads, am I allowed to express myself in colorful fashion on this podcast, or is this a family-friendly show?
This is the furthest thing from family-friendly.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, you can.
I use the same approach on Wrong Ring. So.
So, yeah, what would have been the first film that Patricia Arquette, obviously she's a... She's one of the ones on this podcast that is somewhat of a, she's getting in on a technicality. That's why I'm only covering the films from 95 to 2002, when she was, for all intents and purposes.
Gotcha, that's totally fair. Well, the first flick I saw her appear in would have been Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warrior. Saw that in the theater. I was a giant, just Freddy freak. I mean, people forget in the 80s how Freddy, for pop culture, was as big a celebrity as, like, Ronald Reagan or Michael Jackson. I mean, he was everywhere in the 1980s. And I was 10 when I caught Nightmare on Elm Street on HBO. I just went all in, watched it every time I could. And so when the third one came around, my friends and I were there, maybe not day one, but we were there early to see it. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know who she was by name, but it's impossible to watch that movie and not completely fall under her spell. I mean, she's just such an angel in that movie. And then I just kept seeing her pop up in movies from there on, whether you're talking about True Romance or whatever. So I became a big fan of her early on. And I guess for me, my fandom of her probably peaked or crescendoed with Lost Highway by David Lynch. Mm-hmm. But she's a marvelous actress and obviously still active to this day. And so yeah, when you sent this list of all these Coppola films and I saw Flirting with Disaster on there, I was like, how's that connected? And I kind of clicked on it. I was like, oh, gotcha. Okay. But I was like, I hadn't even thought about this movie like in 25 years, but I just remember laughing like hell when I saw it. And when I revisited it, right, maybe howl all over again. I've been revisiting certain scenes over and over again over the last couple of days, and I've just forgotten just how good she is and just how good this movie is.
Yeah, it's that thing with this film. Like, whilst doing research, there's not a lot about it. Like, I just typed in on YouTube.
Almost nothing, and, yeah.
Yeah, like, if there's any reviews, a lot of it, you had to put in film because a lot of it was there's a few songs with like the title. I think it's like a Molly Haggard song. And there's people like, first reactions to that. I was like, no, I want to know about the film. I want to know if anyone's reviewed it. So I guess there's something we possibly should talk about before we get into the film itself. And that is the tragic passing of George Segal just yesterday at the time of recording, which seems weird. I feel like I'm somewhat cursed by like going, let's talk about
you,
this
are
film.
You, are you confessing that you killed George Segal?
I did not kill George Segal. That is not what happened.
Yeah, I love George Segal. I guess the first time I ever saw him was when I was in the theater with Look Who's Talking. And he didn't necessarily make a huge impact on me then. But as I got into watching old movies in college, then I'd see him in things like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And I was like, oh, shit, like this guy, he's really good, and he's just got this enormous career going all the way back to 1960. I'm looking at his IMDb page right now. And he always brought his A game. He was always funny as hell. He was always charming as hell. And can play genuinely neurotic, as we see in Flirting with Disaster. But man, he's just one of those actors who probably at one time or another met everybody, worked with everybody, got along with everybody. He just seemed like a delightful fellow in so many ways. And I just love how he's a true working actor, loves staying busy, and just accumulated this giant body of work and, you know, funny stuff like the Larry Sanders Show and things like that. So yeah, I wouldn't say I'm a George Segal fanatic, but it's always great to see him whenever he pops up in anything.
Yeah, for me, he's one of those actors that are kind of like, I don't know. I think at some point I got him confused with Elliot Gould because they very much have that like, they have that similar energy, and it feels like they kind of like walk that tightrope. And I guess that.
And they both came of age at a similar time. They're roughly similar in age, so.
Yeah, so they're both in California Split, the Altman film, and then kind of then had runs in like 90s sitcoms as well, whether it's Just Shoot Me or Friends. And it's kind of, you can very much see an element of Monica and Ross's
dad. Now, I'm seeing here George Segal's from Long Island. Is Elliot Gould a New Yorker as well, or where was he from originally?
Elliot Gould? I'm not too...
They might have that. I mean, it might have a similar kind of New York energy. Elliot Gould is from, yeah, in Brooklyn. So, yeah, once again, two guys, similar age. They both got that New York vibe. So, yeah, that's they probably, who knows? They probably were good pals. But yeah. I honestly don't know.
But they kind of have that like energy about them, especially like George Segal's character in Flirting with Disaster. Yeah, is very much like Elliot Gould's in Friends, that kind of neurotic dad kind of like worrying about everything, and this especially playing against
if David Russell had cast Elliot Gould in the same part, he would have crushed it and done just fine.
Exactly.
Like us who were adopted often have to face a lot of unresolved identity issues.
Mel and Nancy had a typical marriage.
Do you think we're ever gonna have sex?
Definitely.
Until he made a decision.
Aren't we good enough parents?
This is about my real identity. It's about my background.
To find who his real parents are.
I'm Tina Kalb.
Tina is with the adoption agency where you adopted me.
Why does he have to do this roots thing?
We're going to San Diego in the morning.
You are aware that they have a very big car theft problem in San Diego.
They bump you, and when you stop, they mutilate you and then take your car.
It happened to Art Sackhoff.
The mystery of your unknown self is about to unfold.
Hi!
This is your half-brother, man.
Oh, man.
Tina says that most women who gave up their children for adoption in the 60s were independent free thinkers.
You're saying I was a slut?
Valerie's not your mother, Mel.
Of course she's my mother. We have the same forehead.
How could you make a mistake like that?
Oh, my God.
The bump and rub.
Break off, Jack!
Look at this bitch. This is my son.
I always wanted to learn how to drive a big rig.
Drive forward!
Miramax Films presents...
You thought this Fritz Boudreau was your father, but in fact, he's not your father.
The story of how one man went searching for his roots.
This is not the way I planned this trip.
Well, I think you're doing a great job.
And got tangled up along the way.
Which one of you is Mel?
Me.
Is that tyrant your mother?
Saying you're not sure if you're my father?
Who is this man?
He called us his parents.
I think it might be easier at this point just to find an intelligent man to impregnate me.
You're attracted to her, aren't you?
No.
Is there something happening here that I haven't included into yet?
La, la, la. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Ben Stiller, Patricia Arquette, Taya Leone, George Segal, Lily Tomlin, Alan Alda, and Mary Tyler Moore.
Kind of remind me of my mother.
Ow! Flirting with Disaster.
I want you to consider my age and ask yourself how I maintain
this. Mom, why are you doing this?
What is your relationship with this film? When would you have seen it in the theater? Would you have seen it at home? Like, were you a David O. Russell fan beforehand?
I became a David O. Russell fan, like fan, probably. He had that incredible hot streak when he did The Fighter, Silver Linings Playbook, and American Hustle all in a row. Mm-hmm. Just boom, 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 back to back with very little time in between. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is just, he's on fire. But I entered college in 1995, and it was a perfect time to fall in love with movies because the indie film scene was suddenly exploding and kind of transforming into big business. And the New York film scene, the LA film scene, it just had so many giants emerging. like whether you're talking Hal Hartley or whomever. And David Russell is one of those indie kind of guys, who a mini who became a major. And Spankin' the Monkey was a big deal. Flirting with Disaster was a little bit bigger. And then by the time you get to 99, he's doing things like Three Kings and working with big movie stars. And he just kept making big seismic jumps with his career every step of the way. And so I definitely associate him with the indie film scene of the 1990s. And he's just one of those guys who happened to survive the transition where the indie film scene really doesn't even exist in the traditional sense anymore. But I know he's getting back in action now. For whatever reason, he's been sadly kind of inactive the last couple of years. And I didn't see Joy. I don't even know why I didn't see it, because I'd loved his previous three films so much. But I know he's getting back in action now. So yeah, I think David O. Russell has all the talent in the world and loves cinema, loves film history. And I'll be rooting for his comeback all the way. So yeah, Flirting with Disaster, I did not see it in the theater. Caught it either on VHS or DVD. And just screamed with laughter. Tia Leone, or Taya Leone, I'm never quite sure how to say her first name, has this marvelous nervous energy, and she's so physical and so sexy, and just, she kind of steals the movie in a lot of ways, or at least for like the first two thirds. And she's stealing the movie away from Mary Tyler Moore and from Ben Stiller and all these giants who are really experienced with comedy. And I never really thought of Taya Leone as like a comedic actress, but holy cow, in this movie, she just absolutely mops the floor with her entire supporting cast.
Yeah, she's great. And obviously, like, I have a soft spot for her from being in The Family Man with Nick Cage years later as well. There's like that. But yeah, I'd never really seen Tia Leone in too much stuff. And like, even looking for her IMDb, there's like, she's not got like a swath of credits like a lot of the other people in this film do. And well, yeah, before we get too deep into chatting about like kind of our love for certain actors and stuff like that, could you by any chance like tell us what this film is about?
Flirting with Disaster. I'm almost hesitant to describe it this way because it's a term that sometimes gets overused these days, but it actually is, as you mentioned before, it's a movie about identity, and it's a quest for identity. Ben Stiller, he was adopted. He's a New Yorker. He's a neurotic New Yorker, and he's got all these issues with, like, he's got issues about oral sex. He's got issues about naming his child. He's just got all these unresolved questions, and he feels as if he could just find his parents, that the whole world would make sense, and that he'd be able to move on with his life and be a family man, so on and so forth. And, you know, he's got these crazy parents played by George Segal and Mary Tyler Moore, and this lovely wife played by Patricia Arquette, and a newborn baby. But he goes through this agency that's going to connect him with his roots. And so Tia Leone has the idea of documenting. She's trying to get her doctorate, so she wants to document the whole process of him reconnecting. And they go on this road trip. But because she's kind of inexperienced and kind of neurotic in her own way, she and the agency make a few mistakes. So they keep kind of going down the wrong path and meeting all these wild, eccentric characters before finally landing on his actual birth parents. And it's just, yeah, a comedy of errors every step of the way. And their group keeps growing and getting bigger as they go, which is, I feel like, was a great part of a good road trip movie, where you start with one or two people, and by the end you've got this, you know, madcap family of like seven or eight people just getting into all sorts of strange adventures. And every time they meet a new crew, like, Josh Brolin's so good, Richard Jenkins is so good, Lily Tomlin's so good. Everybody's completely insane in this movie. And I just, yeah, I laugh my ass off basically from start to finish.
Yeah, there's something really interesting. And it's like kind of like looking back now. So there's an interview with David O. Russell from the time, and he kind of describes, well, what the media were describing his films as. So they kind of said like he was Roman Polanski with his first film and Woody Allen with Flirting with Disaster. Obviously, looking back from with modern eyes, it's like probably not the best two people to be likened to.
But in the 90s, nobody, let's put it this way. In the 90s, obviously people were aware, like, nothing's changed for Woody Allen or Roman Polanski in terms of what they've done since the 90s. But it's just the way people look at those events has changed. People look at it in a different lens. But in the 90s, it was not controversial at all to constantly talk about and celebrate the films of Woody Allen and Roman Polanski. It wasn't even that controversial up until a couple of years ago. So I came of age at a time where Roman Polanski and Woody Allen were considered, like, you know, giants of cinema. Yeah. So that was very flattering praise at that time, making those comparisons.
And obviously you can see that, like, in this film, like, Ben Stiller is almost like that kind of Woody Allen archetype in this.
Absolutely.
Like, just drenched in neurosis. He's a New Yorker. He's like got all these worries. Even the way he holds himself, he's like very hunched. And it's almost like, I don't know, you get these glimpses of the Ben Stiller that we kind of like would get to know over the next, like...
Yeah, I mean, this is before the Something About Mary, and I feel like the yes. Something About Mary really made him explode. I mean, he'd had the Ben Stiller show, mm-hmm. and he would pop up in things like Happy Gilmore and things like that, but it wasn't until the Something About Mary, which was a monster hit, either summer 97 or 98, I can't remember which summer, but from that point on, he was doing giant movies like Meet the Parents or Tropic Thunder or whatever. He became, like, big blockbuster business. Flirting with Disaster, where he's still... kind of on the fringes of showbiz, about to pop, and you can see he's got all the star power in the world at this point. And he could have easily probably written and directed this himself. Man, this is the same year where he directed Cable Guy. So yeah. Ben Stiller was already off to the races as a filmmaker.
Because you kind of get that really fascinating and interesting thing, because you get, like, especially in those earlier roles, whether it is Happy Gilmore or even The Heavyweights, he's kind of got this like anger to him. He played like a lot of like kind of like and he brings
you can have a glass of shut the hell up. Yeah.
He brings that to the character of Mel. He kind of has that, like, I don't know, broiling, like bubbling anger at all times, but then you kind of get that, like, yeah, lovable guy. And this is almost like a blueprint for Meet the Parents. Instead of that, it's Find the Parents somewhat.
Yeah, like. This is definitely a warm up. And I would say between Meet the Parents and this, my taste goes more towards Flirting with Disaster than Meet yes. the Parents. Meet the Parents got a little more broad. I mean, those movies made hundreds of millions of dollars. So obviously, if you want to follow my advice, you will make far less money. But I enjoy the edginess of the humor, and I enjoy the adult frank sexuality of this. Just like the sexual tension between him and Tia Leone is so amazing right from the word go. I love the fact that he's missed date night. He comes home. Patricia Arquette's trying to get it on with him, and he's trying to hide the fact that this person he's working with is in the living room, and Patricia Arquette's trying to like go down on him while he's holding the baby. And finally he admits that he not only has found his parents, but that someone's going to help him meet them. And they're actually in the living room. And Patricia's like, they're in our home right now. And they go out and start talking to her. But there's just from the moment Tia Leone mentions that she used to be a dancer, you can just tell Ben Stiller's got the hots for her. And then there's this great bit where the camera gets jammed when they meet the first person they presume to be his mother. They're mm-hmm. trying to dig something out, and they're using her skirt to do so, and it gets stuck. And as he yanks the camera up, her skirt comes up, and then they go into a conversation about her legs and how muscular and strong she is, which then transitions into this game of Indian wrestling where you're basically fighting to see who's going to lose their balance first. And it's just, yeah, I love movies where the sexual tension just keeps building and building and building. And inevitably, once they finally, it gets unleashed, Tia Leone just like, throws her leg around him like a boa constrictor. And anyway, it's fabulous stuff.
Yeah, because that kind of like, it's the B&B, right? When they kind of find the tension finally breaks. And
yeah, they bump into each other in the hallway when he's in his underwear and a t-shirt, and she's kind of sobbing about how this whole mission or this whole documentary is kind of coming unspooled. And they kind of kiss each other goodnight, and then just boom, they just collide and get it. And it's only for a couple seconds. And of course, like, they're knocking over tables and lamps. And Ben Stiller tries to walk back into the room he's sharing with his wife and trying to hide the fact that he's got this giant erection. He untucks his t-shirt. And she's like, who's pitching a tent? Like, he's like, I'm feeling really sexual. And, you know, anyway, it's just awesome.
Well, that moment, like, I think, I guess it's that thing. Cause for me, this was a first time watch. Like, watching.
Oh, gotcha. Very cool.
For this podcast. And there's obviously, like, I was kind of watching it with like two sides of my brain, almost like going like trying to look at it in context of like 1996, because I think that's what you should do with films, obviously look at them in the context they were made. But then obviously there's that like niggling thing of looking at it like post Me Too and kind of like post the treatment, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, okay, am I gonna get in trouble for talking about this? Yeah.
Well, no, just like the equality of like, and just kind of like stuff that like through a modern lens, like,
yeah,
how would that look like? Would that be presented on screen today? And it's kind of like that thing of like the way
it'd be a very different thing.
Yes, because yeah. He kind of like comes in, he's like trying to like say he's like, but then you kind of like, I don't know, you get those elements of sadness because like she kind of like sees through his bullshit straight away and is like, well, look at me. And like, I think, I don't know,
she's being very patient to even go on this kind of ill-conceived mission where he should basically just grow up, name the child, and get over all of his issues. But she's trying to help him go through this process. But I guess, yeah, if you were to make this movie today, it would probably be dead on arrival, because I think as a result of people trying so hard not to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, it's almost made this kind of New York edgy style of comedy impossible. And part of like the New York edgy style of comedy, I mean, I go to comedy clubs in New York, you know, prior to COVID, I go to them all the time. There's an intensity to them as an in-your-face quality. And a lot of New York filmmakers have exhibited those qualities over the years, and the comedy 100% reflects that. And it would be very, very hard, unless you're going to do it on a very small budget and just say, consequences be damned, criticism be damned, we're just telling our story our way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't imagine a movie like Flirting with Disaster emerging in 2021 right now, sadly.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, because, like, I don't know, the character, and it's weirdly progressive, but it's weirdly progressive at the same time, because obviously you've got Richard Jenkins and Josh Brolin as this.
Yeah, absolutely. Which in 1996 would have been incredibly rare.
Yeah. And the kind of, I think it was like kind of looking at some background research, and like, it was only like that year that in certain states that like gay marriage had become legalized and adoption had become legal.
Yeah, by 1996 standards, David O. Russell would be like a card-carrying like leftist liberal, and you know, probably check off all the boxes. But you know, people keep changing their lens, mm-hmm. and so it makes things. Anyway, I try always just to enjoy the greatness of film history and not get too preoccupied with like reassessing movies every 3 to 6 months. And so, yeah, David O. Russell is on their side if someone wants to try and cancel this movie for whatever reason, but it's on their side by 1996 standards in the context of this film.
Yeah. Of course. So, what are some of the kind of standout scenes for you in this film?
I mean, you got to... Josh Brolin licking and smelling the armpit of Patricia Arquette, that's pretty famous, where he admits in the movie that he's bisexual, and that you can tell he's still got the hots for this girl he knew in high school, but also wants to have a family with Richard Jenkins, his husband. But he has this weird moment where, I guess there's a transition to the point where suddenly Josh Brolin and Patricia Arquette are driving in a car, and Ben Stiller and Tia Leone in a car, and Richard Jenkins doesn't quite know where he belongs. He feels like he's the fifth wheel, but there's this night where finally the sexual tension spills over for everybody. But then, of course, Mary Tyler Moore, her famous scene where she's lecturing her daughter-in-law about the importance of support and wearing a bra, especially after pregnancy. So Mary Tyler Moore, I think she's in her 60s at this point, yanks her shirt up, and she's showing how like well-endowed and how firm and fit she is at her age. And, of course, she's a legend of American comedy, going back to the Dick Van Dyke Show on television in the 1950s. So that's huge. But the Indian wrestling scene probably makes me laugh the hardest. The way Ben Stiller is losing... And then suddenly, and they're kind of like, their faces are close and they're breathing heavily. And suddenly she just goes, throws him. He goes through all these, like this priceless glass and china. And then the mother comes out. She's like, oh, well, you're going to get a pass because you would have done something like this had you grown up in my home. And then her volleyball daughters arrive and they're constantly like, hitting each other and telling each other the shit. Like, they're so physical and they're so California, so quintessentially so. And Ben Stiller, so New York. It's such a great study and contrast between Southern California and New York. So I think, yeah, the peak for me is the scene with the mother who's got this like deep, strong Southern heritage, which obviously clashes with Patricia Arquette and Ben Stiller, who are all in on their New York heritage.
I love the kind of like, well, I love the Richard Jenkins performance. And I think it's that thing of like, this does feel like a kind of blueprint for a lot of the stuff of like, and around this time, I don't know, like one of the last comedies from around this period I watched was Trapped in Paradise. And it's like a film where like Richard Jenkins doesn't get to flex his like comedy muscle. He kind of gets to play it very straight. Whereas in this, he gets to like go.
He's hysterical. Yeah,
he's great. Like the kind of like the last third of this film when he's kind of like
tripping balls on acid.
Yeah.
He's like, how do you feel? Vivid. I'm seeing colors I don't want to see.
And even before that, when like he's kind of like he goes from his introduction when he's like that kind of like really stern but like unsure federal agent when he's like questioning Mel about destroying the post office and stuff like that. It's just like he gets so much like, I don't know, comedy to like chew over and really gets to like state himself whenever he's on screen. And then
that's when you know you're watching a great comedy, when the director's not afraid to give great lines to the supporting cast. Like Preston Sturges did this in the 40s, where you have these just maniacal casts where anybody from the smallest bit player to the star could have great lines. And that's how Flirting with Disaster is. The entire cast has great beats, great moments, great lines. And it's what makes the movie so enjoyable is that, I mean, a great ensemble cast should not be in service of one star. They should all be bringing the heat in their own right. And so Richard Jenkins, he just hits home run after home run throughout. So does Josh Brolin. There's not a weak performance in this movie. I have certain characters that I prefer over others just out of personal taste. But it's a very deep bench of talent in this movie.
I think Glenn Fitzgerald as Lonnie, like the shitling's like other son, is...
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow you on that.
Glenn Fitzgerald, who plays Lonnie, the...
Gotcha. Sorry, yeah.
The shitlings. I'm going to bastardize it like everyone does.
There's a great debate as to how to correctly pronounce the last name in the film.
But like he's great, and he's an actor. Like I don't think I've ever seen it or like knowingly have seen in anything. And like as you were saying, he gets to do great. And
he's in The Ice Storm, which came out around the same time. He's mm-hmm. in The Sixth Sense, but this is definitely whenever I see him, I'm kind of he's that guy. Blah blah blah. Yeah, but he's marvelous in this.
Yeah, and then like you get David Patrick Kelly for a scene. It's like it's just littered with people. And like for I don't know, I guess like the average film viewer, it would be like. Like Celia Weston, it's like a lot of I recognize that person from stuff, but then like yeah, the principal cast with like Josh Brolin and Richard Jenkins stuff like that. Obviously, people like at the time like what Josh Brolin hadn't really like.
Yeah, he was not Thanos yet. He was not the central villain of the biggest movie franchise in movie history, but he's on his way there. But I mean, Alan Alda, comedy legend. I mean, going back to MASH, and then of course Lily Tomlin. I mean, you look at all those extraordinary Robert Altman films in the 70s she was in, like Nashville. And so anytime you get Alan Alda and Lily Tomlin in the same room together, working off of each other, I mean, their chemistry, it feels like they've been working together every day for decades. Their chemistry is just extraordinary.
Yeah, and like I love like, I'm not sure what version like you've seen, but like because I read that it's not on some, but you get those like check-ins during the credits. Was that on the?
Oh yeah, I got the little post-credit stingers. Yeah, those were all. I watched it on Amazon, and I can't remember when I first saw in the '90s if those were there or not. But I love those little post-credit stingers, especially like Tia Leone, who's now pregnant, who's on the phone with her mother, and her mother's like, "Are you smoking?" And she does this little gesture where she kind of opens her mouth to let the smoke out without blowing it, which is just a great little beat. But once again, that's what makes her so great in this, is that all these like spontaneous, unpredictable little personality quirks that she exhibits throughout. And it's what makes Ben Stiller say to her, "Well, you kind of remind me of my mom, or your nervous energy," which makes her smack him. That's when they finally realize they're not going to be right for each other. She's like, "And by the way, you don't make enough money for me anyway." It's ruthless.
What other, like, I'm trying to think of, like, there are plenty of, like, because this film just doesn't really, like, let up in kind of, like, it's just barreling forward.
And it's short. It's only, what, like, 92 minutes or so? Yes, 92 minutes. People forget or have forgotten the art of the short, concise, economical story. And David O. Russell understands it. But for whatever reason now, again, in Hollywood, they're always saying, you know, your screenplay needs to be 125 or 130 pages, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, no one will ever complain about a movie being too short. And if they think it's too short, they'll just watch it again. But plenty of people will complain if your movie is too long. And also, from an economical standpoint, if your movie's short, you can probably squeeze in another showing per day, which is great for the theaters. It's great for the people who made the movie. And I'm a massive fan of it's like you mentioned Woody Allen earlier. He had this great line where he says, "I can improve any movie sight unseen, make it shorter." And yeah, a 92-minute movie. No one will ever complain about it. People will only complain if they feel like their butt's getting sore from sitting in the seat too long.
Yeah, and it kind of like it just it's like I don't know you and the nature of the film as well, just kind of that kind of road trip aspect of it makes it feel like it's even shorter, because it's like
you're always moving. Yeah,
you're always moving. You're always like, it's what, like every 10 minutes or so you kind of get these set pieces, and it's like we're introduced to a new character, and it's like right up until the end. And it's, and like you said with Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda, like, even though they're not in it until like the last half hour, if that, like 20 minutes, you get that sense of who they are straight away. And it is down to the writing in this film. Like, everyone who's introduced, like, like David Patrick Kelly, you kind of get, oh, he's a bit of a scumbag because they've turned up. He's trying to beat the shit out of them. But like, everyone who's introduced, even up until that late stage,
I love it. This building tension where these are aging hippies who used to make LSD back in the 60s and went to jail, and they're now basically living off the reservation. They have not let go of any of their kind of belief system from that period. But you also know that Richard Jenkins, in spite of the fact that he's in a gay relationship, like, he's also kind of one of those classic, stern, kind of right-wing reactionary law and order kind of guys. And like, well, shit, inevitably something's going to happen where he realizes that he's walking into like an LSD den. And when he's completely hallucinating out of his mind, pulling out the gun, trying to arrest him, it's that you feel like the movie's going to tear itself apart at the seams. And it's delightful to watch.
I love, I guess it's that thing that, like, and it reminds me of like kind of just like older comedies and that. And it's that thing, like, obviously on a script, like, wise, you could be like, oh, it's quite contrived than that, where it's like the car's pulling up, they're getting into the wrong car and stuff like that. But all of that stuff is fun. And this film very much, it has like an element of being like an old, like, 60s.
Yeah, late 30s, early 40s, stuff like My Man Godfrey by Gregory LaCava, or movies like Palm Beach Story by Preston Sturges, that frantic energy. That is, I mean, you know it when you see it, but a screwball comedy is a very specific energy, and usually very fast dialogue, completely insane characters, and you're not looking for plausibility, you're not looking for like gritty realism, you're just looking for laughter, pound for pound, like, how much do you laugh? And I guess one of your famous homebrew critics, Mark Kermode, always says, like, you know you've seen a great comedy when it passes the 6 laugh test, where you laugh involuntarily 6 times, because laughter is an involuntary thing. You don't say, oh, LOL. Like, it just bursts forth from you. And this movie passes the 6 laugh test like in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's got like a very sweet nature to it as well. And like, it's I love that kind of title sequence, the introduction to Patricia Arquette. And I think, like, with what she gets in this film, like, she does so much with it. And she mentioned in an interview, I think from 2015, that like the armpit licking was her idea. She said that.
Oh, nice, excellent. Well, she's playing the straight man in this movie, where she's surrounded by all these maniacs. She's the most rational of them all, and that sometimes it's like being Zeppo Marx in a Marx Brothers movie. It's like, oh, sometimes being the straight man is tough. Or what are you talking about? Like Abbott and Costello. Like, Lou Abbott was a straight man, and Costello gets to do all the funny bits. But I feel like if you were to say if any of the parts are underwritten, you could perhaps say hers. However, as you mentioned, she elevates the role and makes it her own. And I think she absolutely brings it. And you need somebody in there who's just going to remind you that this is a movie about commitment and love and family. And she absolutely nails it, considering the material that she's given. And she gets to lash out here and there when she starts saying Ben Stiller's being an asshole, and she insists upon getting out of the truck. And of course she's right, because he backs up into a post office. But when they finally arrive at his parents' house, and she's like, fuck you, and she goes upstairs. Like, she's saying what probably should have been said to him from the word go. He's being an asshole.
Well, it's that thing, sometimes the audience need like a kind of a surrogate in a film, right? And she very much is that. And there are moments in it when she's almost like, she will openly laugh at what is going on, whether it's the kind of like bump and grab, like that George Segal's character's told him about. And there's that great scene with the guy from the like church group who's trying to give back the jacket. And she just starts bursting out laughing in the back of the car. And it's like, you need someone who's in amongst this madness to just go, this is fucking crazy. Like,
yeah, this is just bonkers. Yeah.
But I think she's like wonderfully sweet as well. And I think, like, I love that kind of like, that title sequence where we get like the kind of, she's trying to look sexy, but then it's like she's back to like, I don't know.
I'm sorry, Petrus, can you repeat that? I'm getting a little bit of a internet lag, and I didn't hear the last like sentence or two.
Yeah, no worries.
Test. Can you hear me, Petrus?
Hello. Yeah. Oh, sorry. It's saying hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I think we're synced back up now. For a second, we had a little bit of lag. Snip,
sorry
snip.
About that. she's like wonderfully sweet in the role she does, and I think like you get that through that opening like title sequence where we get to see
she's getting ready for date night and she's like getting herself all cute. I mean, she's an astonishingly beautiful girl, and you're seeing her from behind getting in her nightie, and but then you see her kind of snacking on the bed, but she is ready for date night. She's ready for business time, and yeah, Ben Stiller obviously is distracted. And even before that, you get this great montage of all these really bizarre looking people in the streets of New York about who they are, who they might be, how they might have come together, and how whoever we are, whatever we're born into, it's basically like cosmic chance or cosmic accident. And I feel like the movie opens up with a really memorable sequence just showing people walking on the sidewalk in New York and how they may or may not be Ben Stiller's parents. And I think it's a very clever opening sequence.
Yeah, one of the things I like about this film, it very much feels like a director kind of like trying out different things, like because like as like it could come across as like a bit disjointed, like especially that opening bit, it seems like something I don't know, but it kind of gives you an idea of who he will become as a director, because like you see traces of like Silver Linings Playbook throughout this, that kind of like the sweet touch, the kind of like the troubled relationship trying to make things work, and the kind of eccentric parents. And David O. Russell's a kind of like interesting director anyway, because you kind of get this like pinball of like I'll do whatever the fuck I want kind of thing. Like, I don't know, like Three Kings, from what I remember, is like a bit more of like an action, like it's got like an action element to it, and like the fighter's very much like very
gritty.
Hard
to pigeonhole him in like in one genre, and he seems to really enjoy experimenting. Like Three Kings is so different from everything that's come before, and Silver Linings Playbook is so different, the fighter's so different. He's always reinventing himself, but then takes long breaks. And I find him, he's very consistent though. I mean, any director who's making good stuff for 20 years or more, that's always a good sign. And Spankin' the Monkey, I think, was like 94 or 95. So here we are, we're 25 years in, and he's still going strong. So I think sometimes people sleep on the fact of just how consistent David Russell is. The one movie of his that I've kind of avoided for whatever reason is I Heart Huckabees. I've never heard anybody recommend that one. And I guess at some point I'll have to see it, but I don't know. Have you ever seen I Heart Huckabees?
No, but it will be covered on this podcast at some point because it has...
Because of Schwartzman?
Schwartzman and Talia Shire are both in that film, so...
Gotcha. You'll have to let me know how it is.
There's a double Coppola connection, and I think recently it's been put on Star on Disney Plus, so it's kind of like that thing of like, there's kind of no more excuses. I haven't got to find an old DVD copy of it floating about or anything like that.
Have you ever seen the behind the scenes viral video from the set of I Heart Huckabees where Lily Tomlin and David Russell have a fight?
Yes, I have. Oh well, I rewatched it again like this morning and kind of prep for this, and it's I know that like I guess it's something we kind of should talk about. I know there's like some like David O. Russell has had some issues as well. Like there's some problematic stuff.
Oh, I know he's got a horrible temper, but beyond the I Heart Huckabees, I'm not aware of any. What did he get in trouble for?
So during the Sony like hack, there was stuff in regards to like complaints about him on American Hustle. I think Amy Adams said like his behavior on set was very like she kind of reduced him to like tears. He reduced her to tears like most days with his kind of temper. And there was I very much implore people listening to kind of like look into it. Obviously I am not very well, and I don't know all the ins and outs of this, but there is there's allegations from his transgender niece about him like inappropriately touching her and stuff like that. So I guess like that kind of like fits in with that kind of like somewhat break he's had since Joy. Like it would have lined
up
with the kind of...
Okay, yeah.
Sony
well, I'll have to do some more digging.
Yeah, and but like Hollywood is, he's still getting another chance, and obviously we'll be back with like I think the cast list for his new film, which is just titled David O. Russell Untitled Project on IMDb at the moment, is insane.
Yeah, let's see. I'm, I'm opening up his page, Untitled, and so it's got, Anya Taylor-Joy, who I love, Margot Robbie, Zoe Saldana, Christian Bale. Yeah, it's a Robert De Niro, Andrea Riseborough, an insane cast, Rami Malek, John David Washington. Oh, I mean, it's Mike, holy crap. Yeah, Mike, Chris Rock. Yeah, this is an insane cast. So whatever he may or may not have done in the past, clearly at least these people are overlooking it or have forgiven him. So this is one of the best casts that you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, I just feel like it kind of it had to be mentioned, but obviously I don't want to come down either way because I don't know enough about it to kind of pass.
Yeah, I'm pretty much a blank slate on all of his bad behavior. So, but like I said, I've seen the video of him screaming at Lily Tomlin, so I know he's got a temper. Beyond that, I'm totally in the dark.
I guess that's why him and Christian Bale get on so well, right? Like they're kind of.
It's fucking distracting. Yeah, I mean that. Hearing him scream with his Welsh accent on the set of Terminator Salvation, that's one of the all time great meltdowns on any movie set.
Yeah, do you reckon that is like kind of like I just have this image of like post shoot, they're kind of like kicking back like. Shooting the shit, just going
out of it. I think it was the first time Americans had heard him speak in his Welsh accent. I mean, we remember him from Empire of the Sun, but I think he was doing a little more of an English accent in that. And so I think Americans were kind of knocked flat the fact that, oh, this guy's from Wales. Like, and most Americans are like, where's Wales? And anyway. Yeah, but Christian Bale, I love him as well. Temper tantrums and all.
Yeah. What are the like, kind of things that I saw that David O. Russell was saying like his influences for this film were films like Shampoo and Heartbreak Kid.
I love Shampoo and Heartbreak Kid. I mean, early 70s comedy, early 70s period. But I mean, Shampoo is one of the best movies about LA and about Hollywood ever made. And it really feels like the end of an era and it has a strange hint of melancholy. But anyone who's not seen it, it is just, Hal Ashby and Robert Town and Warren Beatty and Julie Christie just at the absolute peak of their game. I think it's one of the best movies of like the new Hollywood. And Heartbreak Kid, funny as hell, Elaine May. People kind of forget about her as a director sometimes because, Ishtar, which totally destroyed her career. But prior to Ishtar, very promising director, and Heartbreak Kid with Charles Grodin. I mean, everybody's got to see it. It'll make you shriek.
And then obviously like there's that weird connection that Ben Stiller would then go on to be in the remake of The Heartbreak Kid.
Which I did not see very deliberately and very willfully. It's like, I mean, there are some remakes that are great, like John Carpenter's The Thing or Brian De Palma's Scarface or David Cronenberg's The Fly. So I'm not completely averse to remakes, but you got to do something special.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And what do they always say? Remake a bad film. Don't remake a good film.
Fair. That's totally fair.
But I kind of like, I don't know, like, I find with this film, it's one that I definitely need to revisit. And it's that thing of like, I was kind of like, I'm very annoyed because I got a DVD copy of this, which like clearly states on the back of it, comes with a director's commentary. And I got like all excited. I was like, I can get like some tidbits and stuff like that I can share. Turns out, James, that I was duped. There was no director's commentary on this DVD.
And I did a little digging and I realized that there's almost no background info written on this movie at all. So I think it's just one of those movies where you can just enjoy it or not enjoy it or see it or not see it. And just it is what it is. It's 92 minutes of madcap energy. And if that sounds like your thing, hunt it down. But it's not regarded as some like major building block of film history or anything like that. I just really love seeing all these interesting voices that emerged from the New York film scene in the 90s. Where they're talking like, I mean, Abel Ferrara had been around longer, but he really was thriving in the 90s. And obviously, it's the city of City Lumet and Woody Allen. But in the 90s, you had like Jim Jarmusch firing on all cylinders and Spike Lee. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned before, Hal Hartley and David O. Russell, born and raised in Manhattan. I just love the New York film scene. And I've lived here in New York now for almost 13 years. And while the scene is not what it once was, there's still plenty. I mean, more people go to the movies in New York than in any other city in America. We have more revival houses than any other city in America. This is just a city that loves watching and making movies. And David O. Russell is absolutely a part of that.
Yeah, and you can kind of see that, like, there's obviously there's that lineage, like again, somebody who kind of there are links somewhat, I'm sure we'll get into a bit later, to this film, but like you get like like a Noah Baumbach who kind of makes these kind of very like New York
100%,
centric,
yeah.
And it kind of
Noah
feels,
Baumbach is absolutely a part of that scene.
Yeah, and he's very, you can kind of see like shades of David O. Russell in like Noah Baumbach stuff, like maybe, I don't know.
And they got started around the same time, like Noah Baumbach with Kicking and Screaming. I think that was what, 97 or so? So he's just a couple of years behind David O. Russell and launching his own career as a director. And yeah, so I think they might even be relatively close in age. But I think Noah Baumbach's a little younger in any of it, but they're absolutely part of that same extended family. Movies about relationships.
Mm-hmm. So, and I wanted to, go back to the thing like in this interview when Patricia Arquette was talking about the armpit thing. And it feels like it gives us a bit of context of where she was at. And I kind of like to look at like, if there's things in people's real lives that could have affected their like mentality at the time. And she said, like, if you go out into the single world, you don't know what you're going to get into. And like, that's where like, she was like, you might go home and somebody's into ball gags. She's like, that's why I thought like the armpit licking was a good idea. And all I can think is like, well, she was married to Nicolas Cage at the time. So there was probably definitely some armpit licking going on.
I have no idea what he's into sexually, but if he were to be into something that's off the beaten path, it would not surprise me. But I have no evidence to support or contradict that idea. But one thing, I mean, he's one of the most unpredictable, madcap, strange actors of the last couple decades, and I'm a big Nicolas Cage fan. So, but sometimes the people who, in the terms of their public persona, have a really wild, outlandish quality, they can be a little vanilla behind the scenes. Like porn stars, very famously, they'll do all these crazy things on camera, but in their private sex lives, it's a lot of hugging and kissing and missionary and that sort of thing. So who knows? Maybe Nicolas Cage is kind of boring and vanilla behind the scenes. You never know.
I don't know. I reckon he's probably going in with like dressed like Edgar Allan Poe or something.
Well, I picture him like living in like a German castle, walking around like in a suit of like full plate armor, like wielding like a Zweihander or something like that. Just like, you know, welcome to my home. Like, I am Nicolas Cage, and just acting like a complete lunatic. That's what I would like to believe.
Perfect. So, let's talk about some Coppola connections. Could you find any connections through like the cast or through this film to other members of the Coppola family?
Well, Arquette is in True Romance, which also stars Dennis Hopper, who's great in Apocalypse Now and Rumblefish. So that was one of the first connections where I realized, like, all right, so Arquette does have some other connections to the Coppola, I guess, output or the giant. If you were to look at like everything the Coppolas do from the time of the 70s onwards as a giant extended family, Dennis Hopper appears to have, he never married into it, but he appears to have at least been on the scene and a good collaborator for Francis Ford Coppola.
Perfect. One of the ones I found is David O. Russell is actually in Adaptation. He's like,
oh, interesting.
He's got a cameo, which I guess would have been a favor to Spike Jonze after being in Three Kings. You probably would have been like, I'm making a movie.
I haven't seen Adaptation in well over 20 years, so I totally forgot. I need to revisit that. I remember laughing like hell when I saw it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's this weird thing that, like, I guess Spike Jonze kind of likes to put other directors in as cameos, because there's that great David Fincher cameo in Being John Malkovich. He kind of like crops up in that video at the kind of like newsreel at the end when they're talking about John Malkovich being this amazing puppeteer, and like David Fincher is a talking head during that segment. Another Patricia Arquette one is obviously she's in Bringing Out the Dead with Nick Cage in 1999. She was in Ed Wood, which Stephanie Schwartzman was the part of the like production crew, and she's in A Glimpse in the Mind of Charlie Swan III, which is directed by Roman Coppola.
Gotcha. The only Roman Coppola movie that I've seen, what's it called? CQ, his film about making a science fiction film, either in France or Italy. I can't quite remember. I saw it in the theater when it came out. And obviously, I've seen some of his collaborations with Wes Anderson. But yeah, Roman Coppola seems to be, I guess, less active than Sophia, and obviously less active than Francis Ford Coppola. And sometimes people will assume, oh, you're inactive because you're just not trying. But sometimes you just are trying to get things going, and you just never find the money. You never get the green light. And so who knows? Maybe behind the scenes he's scribbling away, writing lots of scripts. I don't know.
Yeah, he's very much like a producer. And I kind of have this like running joke on the podcast that like he's the middle child who kind of gets like left out of things a lot of the time, because like Sophia's got her own like Coppola wine range, he hasn't got one, and it's kind of like, because he hasn't got that Oscar win, like Francis is like, don't worry about Roman, like we'll leave him out, we'll get him, he can sit on the kids table. But
well, he's a producer on The French Dispatch, the next Wes Anderson flick, yeah. And he has some writing credits. I mean, he worked on Isle of Dogs and he worked on Moonrise Kingdom. Yeah. So clearly, and Darjeeling Limited. So clearly, Wes Anderson really enjoys working with them. And he's got 53 director credits, most of which are video shorts. But if you've got 53 director credits on IMDb, yeah, he's clearly not afraid to get behind the camera.
Yeah, and he's got, you'll find a lot of the time as well, he does a lot of second unit stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so like, I think like, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou was doing a lot of like second unit, and he does additional footage for Lost in Translation. So like, there's these like weird and wonderful kind of like, I don't know. He's very, yeah. I think for me, like, he's one of the most interesting Coppolas, just because like, I don't know. He hasn't got that much output, so he's got like two or three films that are Roman Coppola films, and I guess the most interesting credit he's got is he did the Mariah Carey Christmas special last year for Apple TV Plus.
Oh, which I didn't even see. So,
which is like, and there's this kind of like fascinating thing that you've got two Coppola children have made Christmas specials. So you have A Very Murray Christmas with Sophia, and then yeah. A Mariah Carey, and it just adds to the weird and wonderful thing about that family, whether it's like Francis Ford Coppola doing his kind of run in the 70s, and then you go like, he also did Jack, or like all these kind of like...
That's when I stopped watching his movies. When he made Jack, I was like, you know what? I'm out. Like, you're going this direction. You know, I hope you make piles of money, but I cannot follow you down that path.
Yeah, and it's... Even like some of the 80s output of his, like Gardens of Stone, it's got kind of thing like there's films like since digging into like the family tree and stuff like that. I'm like, I have never heard about these films. And it's like, I'm worried that it's obviously like not a sign of good things to come. I'm like, there's probably a reason I haven't heard about Gardens of Stone or even Tucker, the Man and His Dreams. But I don't know, I'm a big Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, Tucker's one of those movies where I wouldn't even say I like it that much, but I just, when I'm of the age where you just would watch whatever was on. Like, if you liked HBO, you were just at their mercy. And so I just happened to watch it many times over, even though the subject isn't necessarily one that interests me.
Perfect. Well, yeah, is there any other couple of connections you could find to James?
That was the only one that immediately jumped out at me in terms of kind of like playing back to bacon, like the 6 degrees or 7 degrees of separation. And I was just kept trying to think of like, who are her interesting co-stars? Think, oh, well, has Christian Slater done anything with like the rest of them? Or has Bill Pullman from Lost Highway? And anyway, so, but the Dennis Hopper connection was the most obvious, because obviously Dennis Hopper, some people find him really annoying in Apocalypse Now. I think it's a great glimpse into where he was mentally at that time. And then Rumblefish, he's kind of graduated to elder statesman at that point, and he's passing the torch to the next generation of people like Mickey Rourke and Matt Dillon, all those people. So yeah, I really enjoyed Dennis Hopper's association with the Coppola family. And obviously he's older than all of them. I mean, he's got to start in like Rebel Without a Cause in the late 50s. So he was making movies long before even Francis Ford Coppola started writing things like, I guess it was Dementia 13, which he directed for Roger Corman. Mm-hmm. I think that was his directorial debut. But that was like 62 or 63, I think.
Yeah, I think there's like this Tonight for Sure, just before that, which was a kind of like Russ Meyers-inspired like skin flick where it's
a little nudie cutie.
Yeah, where he's like, I think he did like it's a relative like short film that got spliced together with another director's film to create this.
Gotcha.
With like a very loose narrative in the middle of like two characters meeting to be like, let's tell each other a story. And then these like short films play out. There are plenty of other Coppola connections with this film that I will be putting in the show notes for everyone, because otherwise it's just going to be a man reading out a list of so-and-so worked with so-and-so, and that's not fun for anyone. So let's talk about scoring this film. The scoring on this podcast is very flippant and kind of throwaway, but if you were to pair a wine with this film, James, what wine would you pick?
I might be the worst person on the internet to ask, because my knowledge of wine is one of the things. My entire life I've kept saying I need to learn about wine, and I've dated girls who are really into wine. I have my siblings who are really into wine. I've always been a whiskey man. I love single malts. I'd probably choose a nice single malt, like something like, you know, like Macallan or Talisker or Lagavulin or Lafroy. I really enjoy whiskey and wine. Have a like family dinner or on a date or something like that, but I really can't make a recommendation that would have any weight, because my palate is so unsophisticated and so uneducated that I'm a lost cause on that front.
I'll throw out mine, which is just like a kind of I'm thinking like a sparkling light white wine, kind of leave you a bit dizzy and a bit giddy, which I think this film very much does. It's kind of like you want something.
Yeah, I guess something that makes you feel up. Something that makes you feel giggly. Yeah, like champagne would be great. Something, I guess I lean toward the mean and surly alcohol, but in that it is such a light comedy, a light white wine of some kind would probably be very appropriate.
Perfect. And how much like, yeah, if this were on a wine list, this film, how much are you paying for it? Are you kind of, Are you looking at the first page where it's the houses, or are you turning over to the more expensive stuff?
Well, I'm sorry, Petros, you're frozen. I missed the last question. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can
hear
you.
Test, can you hear me?
Test. Yeah, can you hear me? Can you hear me? James?
It's a little kind of... I think I can hear you now.
Hello.
All right, yeah, I can hear you now. So I missed the last question, the follow-up question about wine.
No worries. So if this film were a wine, are you looking on the cheap list? Is this a house wine, or are we flipping over the page to really spend the big bucks on this?
That's an interesting question. I guess I'd probably say it's a good local wine. Is it going to be served like a Michelin rated restaurant or whatever the case might be? Like, I don't know, but if you are in wine country, like, oh, this is one of our good solid local brands. And as somebody who lives in New York, I feel like David O. Russell is one of our good solid local filmmakers. So you're not going to serve it to the Queen of England, but there are going to be its fans who will go to the mat defending it.
Perfect. Yeah. I definitely think that you're like, I tell you, if you're a fan of this brand of wine, as it were, if you're a fan of like the kind of screwball comedies, you're going to seek out this bottle of wine. So yeah, it's definitely
absolutely.
And I definitely think there's the element of it being like a somewhat acquired taste to some palates.
Agreed.
Like,
yes.
Amazing. So, would you recommend people seek out this film if they haven't seen it already?
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially, I feel like, over the last 10 years or so, it's probably been the weakest period for comedy and movies. While comedy podcasts and comedy, like in stand-up, you can make a case for having never been better. But in movies, I think it's never been worse. And if you need to be reminded that movies can be funny, surprise, surprise, definitely hunt down Flirting with Disaster. I miss great comedies. In the 90s, I had a lot of edgy, dark comedies. People like... Todd Solondz doing things like Welcome to the Dollhouse and Happiness. I mean, the 90s was a great time to be young and having a taste for edgy comedy. So I miss it.
Perfect. Yeah, I definitely think like this one, and the fact that there's not a lot out there, I'm assuming. And like when I put the word out on Twitter and stuff like that for people to kind of like get their opinions. A lot of people haven't really come forward. It feels like it's a massively underseen film. And I would say see it for kind of like, if you've got that fascination like me to kind of see like the seeds of who an actor will become, I think this is perfect to see that for Ben Stiller. And it's I think it's always great to see Patricia Arquette kind of flexing that comedy muscle. And let's be honest, like, it has to be the best armpit licking cinema history, right?
It is the Citizen Kane of armpit licking movies.
Perfect. But again, who's keeping track of those? I'm sure. Yeah. I say that there's probably I'll search Letterboxd and there'll be some weird.
Somebody's got like a top 100 list. Like, whoa, okay.
Yeah. That's that very much seems like the kind of thing you would find on Letterboxd these days. Amazing, James. So. Before we start to wrap things up, there's a few questions I like to ask that are very cruel on my part, and I'm kind of glad that I'm asking them and I'm not answering them. First of which being, if you were to keep one Coppola family member, but in doing so you get rid of the filmographies of all of the rest of them, who are you keeping?
Keeping Francis, and it's no contest. While I love and admire so many of the contributions the rest of the family's made, in the end, it all boils down to Godfather 1, Godfather 2, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now. And I think if you want to look at hot streaks for filmmakers, directors cool off. Directors get hot, they cool off, but they kind of come and go. You're lucky if you get to make any movies. You're even luckier if you get to make one great movie. But if you're able to sustain a certain level of quality for a decade and kind of dominate, that's a very rare achievement, and you can make an easy case for Coppola being the most important American director of the 1970s, a period where there's a lot of great American filmmaking going on with like Sam Peckinpah and Robert Altman and Peter Bogdanovich and Martin Scorsese and so many great filmmakers from that period. So in the end, Francis Ford Coppola, I would even say keep Francis Ford Coppola in the 1970s and disregard everything else if I really had to pick and choose.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I do very much agree with you that kind of like, four-film run is nearly unbeatable. Can you think of anyone else who's kind of had that, like, I don't know, like, I guess, like, people would argue maybe Rob Reiner had, like, a very good run at, like...
Oh, yeah, I mean, I grew up on his stuff. I love Princess Bride, and I love Stand By Me. I love that period, but Rob Reiner... I think of him more as an actor, and he directed some damn good movies, but Francis Ford Coppola showed us kind of what movies can be or what directors can aspire to. And yeah, it's genuine movie greatness. I would say that you could even make a case for The Godfather as like the great American movie.
And it's that thing as well that like behind the camera, whether it's like trying to set up American zoetrope or like his involvement with George Lucas, that like, depending on where you fall on like Star Wars and stuff like that, you kind of wouldn't have those. You wouldn't have that at all if it wasn't kind of like Francis spotting that kind of weedy little kid with glasses and going like, "Hey, you're one of the only other
taking him under his wing." Yeah,
yeah, you're the only other person under the age of 50 on this film set. Come here, like I'll produce a couple.
Absolutely.
So like, I think the more and more I dig into it, the more I kind of like, I'm fascinated. And especially like, he's one of the best directors that's ever been, but at the same time, one of the worst businessmen there has ever been. Like, there's this kind
of... That's
totally
fair. Yeah, I mean, the documentary that his wife shot, Hearts of Darkness, which is about the making of Apocalypse Now, if you want to see a portrait of a mind in a state of disarray, watch Hearts of Darkness.
Yeah, there's this kind of like thing of like, he's just always on the brink of bankruptcy, and you kind of like, you see that
complete and total catastrophe. Yeah. And he says stupid things like, "Oh, I always felt like if I spend the money in a really reckless, frivolous fashion that I feel like it's going to go further." It's like, no, that's what, how a child thinks. The truth is the exact opposite. But that's how your movie went from $10 million to like $44 million in budget in the span of like 2 years. So
yeah. And I was reading something recently where they were kind of talking about like, it's when he's up against the wire, like, and that thing of like everything falling apart and the pressure's on, when he seems to have made his like his best work, like that kind of in the 70s, where it's like nobody believed in him with The Godfather, and like Godfather Part 2, it's like that thing, like even he didn't really want to do it, and he had that pressure on him to make a kind of sequel that it kind of became so great. And it's, yeah, when he's kind of relaxing and eating pasta and drinking wine in the 90s, and like he's just getting bucket loads of money thrown at him, that his films are no longer interesting.
Yeah, success can be ruinous for a great artist.
Yes.
For some.
Others it can be a firecracker up the arse. But let's answer the real question I'm trying to figure out here is, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
This is one of the things like, who's the greatest fighter of all time? Like it's very debatable, but it's a very fun debate.
Yes.
And movie history has a lot of good ones. Like for me personally, like the Barrymores are major, and we still have Barrymores to this day, and they got their start 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. I love the Fondas. They're still going strong. They go back a ways. I can't live without the Marx Brothers. In terms of sheer volume and numbers, it's hard to top Harry, Albert, Jack, and Sam Warner. I mean, they created Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers cranked out a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. So the Warner family, they might always reign supreme, but the Zanucks might say, no, it's us. It's like, you know, Daryl Zanuck and Richard Zanuck and so on and so forth. But if we're going to go down to my personal favorite, my personal taste, I'm going to go with the Houstons. Love John Huston, one of my favorite, all-time favorite filmmakers, great writer, great director, great character actor. And he's got the distinction of directing both his father, Walter, and his daughter, Angelica, both to Oscar-winning performances. And I like that family quite a bit. Their volume is not as big as the Coppolas, mm-hmm. and they haven't produced as many giant figures because it's really just Walter and John and Angelica and maybe Danny. But there are a couple of them. But I really love the Houston family and find their whole saga to be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and the only other family to have the three generational Oscar win as well. Like, obviously, the Coppolas and the Houstons are the only ones to do it. And again,
yeah,
like,
I think family reunions would be a lot of fun with both clans.
Yeah, and there's definitely some crossover with the whole like Wes Anderson connection, and even we mentioned earlier Gardens of Stone, Angelica Houston pops up in that. So I look forward to kind of delving into some of her.
We need
films.
To convince the two families to marry together to create the biggest, grandest filmmaking family, extended family of all time.
I'm trying to think, like, because in research of this podcast, I think the most, like, kind of Oscar-winning family of all time is the Newmans. So, like...
Oh, interesting.
Randy Newman and, like, his family. Yeah, because his uncle and his dad were both composers, right? So, like, I think...
Gotcha.
I think they kind of, like, sweep up on that because... I don't know, your production rate can be a lot more and stuff like that. So they've got an easier chance, I guess, on kind of winning all those Oscars. Amazing. So let's get to a question that, yeah, I guess is on a lot of people's minds and possibly the reason I'm doing this whole podcast. What does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation, James?
Now, when I saw this question, I didn't know if it was like you actually wanted me to get like the right answer, or if it's more of like a philosophical question. And the honest answer is I don't know, because I could look. I don't even know. I saw it when it came in the theater. I haven't seen it since. It's been almost 20 years. And so I didn't know if even in the movie, if the answer is even there. Does he whisper it in her ear and we don't hear, or what? You have to remind me of how the scene unfolds. I didn't want to cheat, but also I wanted to try and figure out an answer that was like in the spirit of the question.
It's filmed like too far away for there to be like for like.
All right. Well, then I'm just gonna go with like a cheap, easy answer from the bard himself. To thine own self be true. The line from Hamlet, because that's, I guess, a cheap, almost kind of like predictable, generic bit of inspirational poetry that I can just pull out of my ass at the drop of a hat. So yeah, that's what I'm going with, right or wrong.
Yeah, a kind of what I really like is, you mentioned him earlier, Mark Kermode always said that he says, "Come with me. I've just got Garfield, and I'm gonna have loads of money." So like that's what he says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of
Very nice. That works. No, it reminds me of Brett Easton Ellis has a film podcast, and at the end of every single podcast, he asks all of his guests the same question: "What do you think of the Eagles?" And you get a wide range of answers, but it's a great Rorschach test to see where people stand on pop culture and pop culture history. Because some people are like, I've never heard a song by the Eagles. And other people are like, oh, it's like, you know, best-selling band of all time, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, you always get a wide range of answers. So I'm all for an interesting kind of a gimmick to bring an episode to a close.
Amazing. Does anyone ever answer that question, like talking about the Philadelphia Eagles? Like just totally misinterpreting the question entirely.
I think... Because most of his guests are filmmakers, they always steer toward, because until you just said it, it didn't even occur to me. Oh, yeah, the Birds. Like, you know, like the team that everybody loves in Silver Linings Playbook so intensely. Yeah, so I guess all roads lead back to David O. Russell.
Perfect. That's it. That feels like a perfect place to cap this episode off. So before I let you go, where can people keep up to date with everything you're doing, whether it's Wrong Real or Geeking with James Hancock and stuff like that?
So I have the podcast Wrong Reel, which is more devoted to film history, and those are long form conversations where we tackle filmographies and things like that. And so you can find that anywhere you find podcasts. And if you were looking for short form content, my YouTube channel, Geeking with James Hancock, is more pop culture and more current. It's more preoccupied with like franchises and things like that, genre storytelling. So if you lean more towards like the Criterion Collection, go to Wrong Reel. If you lean more towards the Marvel Cinematic Universe, go to my YouTube channel. But yeah, and on social media, on Twitter, just at Wrong Reel, and you'll find all my content.
Perfect. Thank you very much for coming along and joining some dots and making some Coppola connections with me, James.
Well, thank you so much for the invite. I greatly appreciate it. And it's always great to make a new connection through the Twitterverse. I really appreciate it. It's been great. I've had a blast talking to you.
As always, guys, thank you so much for listening, and thank you once again to James for coming and joining me. However, he didn't find the Coppola family to be the greatest film family of all time. Maybe I can get him on again and really persuade him next time. If you're a fan of Flirting with Disaster or any of the films that we've talked about, please do be sure to get in touch on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd, all at Caged In Pod, or always catch me by email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As for next week's episode on the podcast, I'll be joined by podcaster, writer, and film journalist Helen O'Hara to talk about the Robert Schwartzman starring The Princess Diaries. As I say every week on this podcast, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. So as always, I've been Petr Spatsnivis, your guide through the wonderful world of the Coppola family tree. So make sure you keep it Coppola, and I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Droop Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.